When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brian Norcross. This is Fox Weather's Tracking the Tropics podcast, number 9 of the 2022 hurricane season. Today's episode is very special to me. It's a conversation with news anchor Kelly Craig and Sports End news anchor Tony Segretto. 30 years ago, Kelly, Tony, and I spent the night together broadcasting on TV and radio as Hurricane Andrew made landfall in the southern part of Metro Miami. We talk about what TV, Miami, and life were like in the early 90s, and how our TV station, WTVJ, was able to stay on the air and connected to people who were scared to death and whose homes were coming apart, and what that night felt and sounded like. We refresh each other's memories of that seminal time 30 years ago. Even if you know the Hurricane Andrew story, I think you'll enjoy hearing from Tony Segretto and Kelly Craig. Our conversation is coming up in just a moment. I'm recording this on Tuesday, September 6, 2022. There are two systems active in the tropics today. Danielle and Earl are heading into the cold North Atlantic to die, though Bermuda is going to have to watch Earl when it comes by later in the week. Robust disturbances are coming off Africa as we expect this time of year, but so far they've all been tracking north. But next week, the pattern might shift a bit, pushing systems farther to the west. There's still a lot of hurricane season to go. The peak on September 10th is the date on the calendar that we're most likely to have a named storm in the Atlantic, the Caribbean, or the Gulf of Mexico, looking at the long-term averages. But in terms of the number of hurricanes that form, more happen after September 10th than before. So, bottom line, again, there's lots of hurricane season still, even on average, to go. This has not been an average season, of course. Even with two recent storms, we're still behind the average dates, which would be 6 named storms as of tomorrow, and 3 of them being hurricanes. We'll soon be at 5 and 2, I think, so it's not that far off the charts crazy or anything. It's just been kind of weird how things have developed. So let's take a break, and I'll be back with my conversation with news anchors Kelly Craig and Tony Segretto in just a moment.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Hi, guys. So great to see you. Thanks for coming on.
Great to see you, too. Seen.
Nice to still be seen and blinking our eyes and smiling with our teeth shining.
Yeah, exactly. Can you believe it's been 30 years since Andrew? I mean, I guess that just proves we're getting old. But, Tony, I've been asking a version of this, you know, over and over this year. So let me ask you, how do you reflect on the 30 years? Does it seem like yesterday or does it feel like a previous life?
It seems like a previous life in some circumstances, but, you know, it's interesting. I was telling my wife, Roseanne, that 2022 for me has been like this banner year in terms of resurrection, because it's also the 50th anniversary of the 1972 undefeated team for the Miami Dolphins.
Exactly.
And as a result, I have been asked to do multiple interviews. I'm basically the last man standing who covered that team. Mm-hmm. So I've been asked to do a number of interviews, and then Andrew pops up and it's 30 years. And for me, I kind of tell stories like this. When people ask me about Andrew or people ask me about the 782 team, right? when you think about those moments, that moment, it's real again and it's current. But until you resurrect that, it's in the past. But when people still to this day, and I know they do this with you, Brian, and I know they do it with you, Kelly, when they still see you and they go, I have not met you before, but you got me through Andrew, or, you know, thank you for saving my life. Those moments are not only chilling, do they give you goose leather, but they give you this sense of, oh my goodness, it really wasn't that long ago. I mean, 30 years ago, you know, when we were 12 years old, 30 years was, oh my gosh, that's like an eternity. How is that ever going to happen? But when you're our age, and I don't mean to even assume that we're old,
really?
It's not that far. So that's kind of how I look at it. But the last week or two since the anniversary date, Andrew's been very real for me in terms of seems like yesterday.
Yeah. Kelly?
Same thing. Visceral reaction. Still have the visceral reaction that you, as Tony described, you truly relive it throughout your entire body. And I also look back on it and say that was a completely different time in the sense that there was no internet, really. Few of us were using cell phones. All we could communicate with was radio, newspapers, television. So the importance of what we were doing was magnified that many of our young people, including our own children, may not even understand. Mm-hmm. It was an entirely different time. And yet, as you all say, when people bring it up and they say to you, I can't believe that night. Can you believe it? Boom. It all comes back in an instant.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's exactly what I say, is that some things I can picture like they were yesterday. On the other hand, you know, when you think about life in 1992, let alone 1972, you know, that was a whole different way of living. I mean, what a simpler life that it was, that, you know, once you left home, you couldn't use a phone generally, even though I did have one of those big brick things that lived.
Yeah, you needed luggage for that. You need actual luggage. That wasn't a carry-on. You had to send that through the airplane there.
Right. Yeah, I left it under the seat of my car and was only for emergencies. And, you know, it wasn't a thing you talked on, really. So you communicated at home. You had a beeper and an answering machine. And when you were home, you were disconnected from work. So that was so fundamentally different, I think, than time today. But I just spent a lot of time in South Florida, all over South Dade, talking to people in Homestead, doing an hour special that we ran on Fox Weather that was really ended up terrific. We had a fantastic producer. And it's amazing for how many people, in fact, for all the people that lived down there at the time, they divide their lives between before Andrew and after Andrew. And you know, that event is a seminal event in their life.
You know, I have to share, and I want to put this in the context for people who may remember us, and then so maybe some who don't even know who we are until right now. I think what made this work for the three of us is that I don't think people realize how independent we all were, but how close we all were and how connected we all were. You know, in my world, in your world, Brian, I mean, we were outliers, right? The weather guy and the sports guy. You know, they were sort of like, okay, they're here, but we're going to go with Kelly and news right now. But you and I had an amazing connection. You loved sports. I loved weather. You traveled with me on sporting events.
You taught me Notre Dame. Yes, that was one of the great moments.
Yeah. In fact, when my son went to Notre Dame, I told him, I said, you need to go to the Studebaker Museum, because that's where Brian and I went. And then you came to Florida State because that's where you went and you taught at Florida State. So we were very, very connected in that way. And Kelly, you and I just hit it off because we were co-anchors together and we appreciated each other's humor. And I'm not sure anybody at that television station could have quipped with us. We kind of put quipping at a brand new standard. So when you put those three people together who truly like each other and care about each other, and more importantly, have this deep respect for each other and what they do, I think that helped us get together. But do you agree, Kelly?
Totally. And dovetailing off of what you said, Tony, you know, most of us who watch the news, and I do consider myself an observer of news, we see maybe 4 minutes of Brian every night, saw maybe 4 minutes, mm-hmm. if that. And I know you had to fight for those 4 minutes sometimes if the show was running over. But to see Brian in action, to watch this man dispense information that I couldn't possibly imagine that you knew was really so impressive. And I found myself just staring at you like, where are you pulling this a font of information from? It was like the storm savant sitting next to me, you know, and it was so impressive. And Tony, I know you'll agree with me and Brian as well. The reason that we got into this business from the very start, if you want to look at it from an existential point of view, is we want to help people. That's at the very core of what we do. We want to help people by letting them know what's going on. We have this information. It's a one-on-one, very intimate communication. And to have been part of that operation was one of the greatest privileges of my life, because I sat next to Tony Segretto and I sat next to the legend, Brian Norcross. And people often ask me, you know, how did you all get through it? And I said, it was because we channeled what people wanted to know, what they needed to know, and we had an expert with us. And again, it was, again, one of the most fulfilling experiences of my entire life.
Yeah, people have said to me all along, you know, how did you sit there all that time? How did you do the 23 hours? I said, where was I going to go? Right? I mean, there was a hurricane going on.
You know? Right. You know, it's a lie, man. Oh, that wasn't even around that. Yeah. Wendy's.
It was nothing. I mean, there's nothing else to do. And that ended up not being my longest night. Actually, Wilma ended up being longer. It was Wilma that stood behind that desk for 30 and a half hours. It was,
you bring up a good point, Brian. My goodness, it was like Hugo, like 3 years before. Yep. Then all of a sudden, Andrew, and boy, wasn't that a harbinger of things to come. It was hurricane after hurricane after hurricane.
Yeah. Well, you talk about shock. I mean, for me, you have to remember, I was doing 4 News Now. I was doing a little walk and talk newscast, but I was still the sports guy.
Right.
And Sharon Scott, the news director, calls me in. Our news anchor decided he didn't want to stay, mm-hmm. if you recall that.
Right. He wanted to get home to his family. Yeah.
He wanted to go home to his family. So she calls me in her office and sits me down and said, we're kind of in trouble. Would you mind sitting with Brian and Kelly? Because, you know, there's nobody else around and we need another anchor, and can you do it? And I'm sitting there thinking, heck, I don't know if I can do it, but yes, I'm here. I'm doing it, you know. And you pull out, what happens is you pull out your history in Florida, and you pull out everything that you've listened to. You know, when you do what we do, if you're not a good listener, then you're not going to be very good at what you do. Not only do you have to be curious to be good, but you need to mm-hmm. be able to listen. And I think that, you know, I listened to Brian a lot. I listened to you know, we had, at the time, Brian, you have to admit, you had a great team of meteorologists. And they weren't just the rip and tear guys or women. They were, if I'm not mistaken, everybody on your team at that time were all atmospheric scientists, where they could, you know, do their own meteorology, because that's what I remember.
Bob Weaver was there, and Bob, you know, the thing that was so great
Bob
about
was
Bob,
brilliant.
Bob, yeah, was Bob brilliant. Was a brilliant broadcaster. Bob knew, and he just knew the audience so well.
Yeah,
you know, he wasn't the big meteorologist and all that stuff. But the thing is, he'd been doing it for so long. He had so much experience with so much, and he was such a wonderful man to be around and so supportive. And then, if you remember, the weekend guy was Brian Allen, and Brian was instrumental in supporting what happened, because, you know, I was sitting at the anchor desk. I wasn't in the weather office, you know, like you would do when you do, some normal kind of coverage. So right. Brian Allen really was the support system there. So, yeah, it was, I mean, it just in general, at that time in broadcasting, we had real pros in all directions. You know, yeah. The
and
people
about how
at the assignment desk in the newsroom and, you know, the news management and so forth, they were really professional.
Think about how it changed. That's what people ask me, like, what do you remember most? And other than the devastation, we could go on and on about everybody has individual stories about what we saw in terms of, you know, no street signs, all of these other things. But when you think about how it impacted people's lives in a profound way, and not just from losing a house, but from moving. And when you think about the footprint of South Florida, how it changed. Pembroke Pines would not be what Pembroke Pines is. How far Weston went west would not be.
Well, everything west of I-75 is really a product of Hurricane Andrew in the southwest county.
It was remarkable how it changed people's lives, how it changed what we did, how it created FEMA. Basically, if it wasn't for Andrew, I'm sure FEMA would exist. I'm sure it would have after Wilma and Irene and storms like that. But goodness me, when you think about that time and the chaos, there was no governing body in which to say, we need help. And until the National Guard came in building Tent City, I mean, it was a free-for-all. And yeah. The absolute free-for-all. It was unbelievable to see.
It was anarchy. Really horrible. Yeah. So but we'll talk more about that. I talked to Bob Sheets and Kate Hale. My podcast last week was with Bob Sheets and Kate Hale, which was great to talk to them after all this time. So Kelly, you came to Miami in 1990. Was it from Tampa?
Tampa.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was the year I started it at WTVJ as well. And Miami's such a, you know, different and unique city now. I mean, there is no place like Miami. Did it feel at that time, though, that you were going for a Miami experience, or was it just a bigger TV market and I imagine a good opportunity?
Well, I had been to Miami several times, and it, you know, unlike some other markets that were a little bit more provincial, mm-hmm. not necessarily Tampa, because that, of course, obviously is a huge major city as well. But it was the global aspect of Miami that really attracted me. It was exciting. It was young. It was just coming up to the whole South Beach experience was just blooming. A lot of young people. It was vibrant. Mm-hmm. It was banking. It was Brickell Avenue. It was so exciting and never a dull moment. I always said, and this was long before I got here, if you can cover news in Miami, boy, you can cover it anywhere. And so, yes, it was a privilege and a challenge to come here, but also to live here as well. Because you talk about a melting pot. Some may say, well, it's not a melting pot because not everybody's melting. Maybe more like a stew. Okay. Everybody has their little flavors in the pot and we enjoy them. It was such a wonderful experience. And as Tony suggested, once everything hit the fan after Andrew, you know, I was in the field for weeks and weeks and weeks talking to the people, and you really saw them coming together to help each other. There were no, yes, as Tony suggested, and you as well, Brian, in some cases it was anarchy, but as the weeks went on, you really saw literally the neighbors coming together to help neighbors. People who hadn't even spoken to each other before. Right. It really did kind of change the whole vibe and complexion of Miami. And
The differences melted away. They really did.
Yeah, they really did. Mm-hmm. And I remember something very specific you said at this point. You said to the people, we are going to rebuild and it's going to be even better than before. And don't you feel guilty about that. Don't feel mm-hmm. guilty about that. Because of what you went through and the dollars that would have to be spent, the tens of millions that would have to be spent. And I never forgot that, because today when I go back through Homestead and some of the coastal areas, I worked in Palmetto Bay, they have beautiful homes there. And I'll talk to the people and they'll say, you should have seen this after Andrew. I didn't have a roof. The whole thing blew off as a whole. So things have really changed, and I don't think Miami will ever be the same. Certainly nobody took storms for granted after that, did they?
Yeah, no. For sure. So in Tampa or Miami or other places that you've been, had you ever been through a hurricane before, Andrew?
I had never been through a hurricane. And I thought to myself, okay, this is going to be scary. But you know what? There are thousands of people like me at home who have never been through a hurricane either. And some of them are going to be alone, as I would have been had I not been there. I wasn't married. I would have been there probably holding the door as well. So what you try to do is say, okay, I got this. But the thing that I could contribute is to be the conduit for people like me and others who have questions, who have never been through a storm, and to ask questions. And to, if I was scared, I said, this is scary, you know, because you want to connect with the viewers. And hopefully by being vulnerable and honest, we were able to ask the questions of you and others who were calling in and say, what are you feeling now? How are you doing? Are you hanging in there? What's going on? And they were very, very open and honest, mm-hmm. you know, with what they were feeling. And I think it you, Brian, handled it beautifully.
Let's take a quick pause. We'll be back on the Fox Weather Tracking the Tropics podcast in just a moment. Tony, you grew up in South Florida, so you must have been around when there used to be hurricanes, right? And Donna and Cleo and Betsy?
I was through Donna and Cleo. In fact, just before Donna hit, I remember my dad, God rest his soul, brought me home little baby chickens. And you know, being Italian and my entire family, pretty much they all were farmers in Jersey, and I lived on a farm when I would visit New Jersey. It was just kind of natural to have a garden and have chickens and ducks and whatever. So he brought these chickens home, and we had a carport. And that's where the chickens lived, in the carport, in a little cage. Well, when Donna hit, I basically would go out and try and check on them but the wind was swirling, and that was my first experience to anything like that. And we really weren't aware of, everybody lost power, and we were watching Bob Weaver until we lost power, and we didn't even know that there was an eye of a hurricane. So we were one of those, you know, that stupid ones that went out in the eye of the hurricane. Oh, it's all over. Look at this. Wow. Isn't this amazing? It's so calm. It's so nice. And then all of a sudden, boom, you know, you get nailed with the back end, and you learn pretty quickly about a hurricane. My chicken survived. Everybody else survived. But it was
because it was a fringe effect. I mean, Donna kind of was a huge, monstrous storm, unlike Andrew, right? It went up. It kind of went up to the west.
But little did we know at the time, when you're young, you know.
Well, and we didn't have satellite pictures. There were no satellite pictures of Donna. Right?
You didn't know. So I lived through a bunch of that, and I think if – again, you know, you're taking this guy from, you know, one venue of his life, and you're putting him in another one, right? So I'm in there with an experience of Kelly and your experience as a meteorologist. My experience was living in South Florida. So I was able to identify people from where they were, whether it was Hialeah or Homestead or Palmetto Bay. I had been at all those places. I had been around a long time. And I remember just listening to people ask questions, and Kelly and I would both kind of latch on to some of what we learned from you during that period of time. You know, I wonder today how many young people walking around with the name of Andrea and Andrew I wonder how many there, because I remember actually one woman who was pregnant at the time. She called us, and we had told her to get into the bathtub with the mattress, and her roof was coming off, and she was pregnant. And I remember soon after that, after Andrew, we found out from that woman, that family, that the baby was born. It was a boy, and they named it Andrew. Mm-hmm. So after that, I always sort of wondered.
I've met a few over the years, and lots of pictures of dogs and and cats and
I think that being able to grow up in South Florida, if anything, gave me an opportunity to feel like, okay, I belong with this trifecta here, and I was just honored to be able to, you know, add what I could or at least latch on real quickly. And I thought it was quite interesting that, if you recall, once Tent City was up, we're, 3 weeks after the storm, and everybody's still reeling, there was this decision made by our county commissioners and mayors, you know, whether or not the University of Miami was supposed to play a football game. Mm-hmm. And I remember there was this big discussion about whether to play this game because everything was so impacted. And they had decided that everybody needed some sort of mental break. And even though no one could watch it on TV, they could still listen to the game on the radio. And how they decided Miami could play. And I remember walking around.
I had forgotten that. Yeah, that's right. That was the idea, though, was that people were so... just so tired that it would be a good thing. Yeah.
And I still get, I mean, I get chills just talking about this. I remember walking around Tent City and hearing the echo of Sonny Hirsch, mm-hmm. God rest his soul, mm-hmm. doing that UM football game. Mm-hmm. And it was just amazing to me how that one moment, which was 4 hours long, was able to at least put a Band-Aid and a little bit of salve on the all the sores and all of the trauma and terror that people were going through. Listen, they were all living in a tent. Mm-hmm. It was a commune. It was, you know, it was Woodstock under control.
Well, not just there. I mean, nothing was normal. That was the thing, is nothing was normal for anybody. I mean, the poor people in South Dade, for sure, but for nobody, really, things were normal at that point. You know, and I hadn't thought about this in a long time, but that's as opposed to the Dolphins the day before, Andrew, had the football game, right? They played the football game that Sunday. When the storm was forecast, this significant hurricane was forecast to hit South Florida, but they still played the game. I don't remember all the dynamics about that, but I do remember that there was discussion.
I bring it up because I thought it was a real important moment in the recovery of what people were doing, right? Because mm-hmm. it gave them that mental break. Not only were they going through the displacement, but they were going through this whole process. Okay, now what? Okay, I'm right now I'm safe. I've got a place where I can lay my head, whether it's a cot or a bed, but I have no house and I have no belongings. Where do I go from here? How do I personally, with my family of four, rebuild? So if you could give that one little family just 4 hours where they can just zone out and kind of refresh and then maybe go with a different perspective. And I thought it was a brilliant move and one that took a lot of courage for our leaders to do and for the University of Miami to agree to. So I agree.
I remember that. I remember thinking, okay, this is a good move. People need this kind of thing. So I remember you, if I recall, you got started in broadcasting when I did, 1968.
Yep.
And then you ended up working for this sports powerhouse. So I mean, WTVJ really was the sports station for decades. How did all that evolve where you became, you know, the sports voice in South Florida?
I thank God for Bernie Rosen.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That's all I can say. And I get choked up. I was 17 and a half years old when I started in 1968. And I was, a gopher, you know, Tony, go for this, Tony, go for that, you know, whatever it was. And then evolved, you know, with just amazing mentors, Bernie Rosen, Mike Pearl, Ed Gorin. I mean, you're talking about icons in the business. Mike Pearl went on to basically run the Olympics for NBC and ABC at the time. Mm-hmm. Ed Gorin, who's still with us, ultimately was the president of Fox Sports until recently. And to be mentored by them and to be nurtured by them and to be taught how to be a professional in that world of sports was remarkable. And then to understand the power of that department. There were two departments in the country, two local departments, sports departments in the country that were looked upon as network quality, and that was us and WRC in New York and Washington, mm-hmm. where I wound up doing for 29 years the George Michael Sports Machine.
Right. George Michael, who came was a disc jockey in Philadelphia and went to Washington and became this great sports guy because he didn't just tell you the scores. I mean, George Michael was a real personality, really.
I mean, you know, he was off the screen. He was something else. I remember sitting in my office and having one of the secretaries come in. This was after a Super Bowl, and she said, "We have a call for you from George Michael," and that's when Wham was really big. And I'm thinking to myself, "What in the world is George Michael calling me for?" Mm-hmm. And it was George Michael from WRC, right. And you know, he had a very gruff and very you know, no nonsense type of personality. And he says, "Hey, I saw you during the Super Bowl. Would you be interested in filling in for me? They're forcing me to take days off." And that one call turned out into a 29-year career with George Michael, flying up to Washington sometimes 7, 8, 9 times a year to do the precursor to what ESPN was. So to be able to do that, and all because of what Bernie Rosen set up at WTVJ, that's what this was about. You know, I was part of a team, and that was remarkable. And to be taught how to be a professional, and to love your craft, and to how to do it the right way, and how not to be a rip and read guy, to be able to spend time. You know, for me to say to this day that, you know, Don Shula was one of my dearest friends. I mean, when Don died, I was like a dad died. You know, I would go to his. When he was retired, I'd go to his house and have breakfast with him. You know, to be able to be around people like that. And I tell people all the time, because of that department, I spent months on end with Muhammad Ali. Mm-hmm. I would go to the Fish Street Gym every day.
Yeah, think about the people that came through Miami.
Film his workouts. At that time. Yeah. You know, I would be with him every day, and to be friends and close with Angelo Dundee, who would send me postcards from every fight, from Zaire, from, you know, all these different championship fights, to be able to be with these people. You know, my first interview that Bernie Rosen sent me on was with Jesse Owens.
Wow.
When you get to be able to do these things, and during Andrew, in fact, in the studio, I went and wound up interviewing Jesse Jackson. He had come in.
Yeah, I remember. I remember him coming and sitting on the anchor desk.
As a matter of fact. That sports platform, and I have to tell you, other than Kelly, okay, and this is the God's honest truth, and you talk about pulling a curtain back. We talk about how it changed people's lives. Andrew changed my life in a profound way because I went right from sports to sitting in the chair. Mm-hmm. And I remember my first day of walking into that newsroom, all these people were, when I was sports guy, all these people are my friends. And now here's the sports dude walking into the newsroom. Now he's going to try and be a news anchor. Like, what the F is going on here? Like, how can they, pardon my French, but how can they do this to us? How can this guy be, you know, sitting in a chair like that? There's no way. And Kelly was one of the very few that you're going to be doing, you know, you'll be fine. You'll be great. I'm not making this up. It's the truth. And I remember my very first day in news, Johnny Versace was shot. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm at my house in the morning, I'm thinking to myself, okay, I'm so screwed. They're all mad at me now. I go, I've got to come up with something. I mean, Bernie Rosen would always talk about finding the nugget, finding something that no one else has. How do you find that something? We would never, he told us never to watch other television stations and not read the newspaper, to come up with our own stories. Right? Mm-hmm. It was all about vetting out, tilling the soil, getting those stories. I'm batting my head against the wall going, what am I going to do? And my phone rings at the house. And it's a friend of mine who's a chef, who I hadn't heard from in 2 or 3 years. I didn't even know where he was anymore. I said, well, I want to come see you. What restaurant are you cooking at? He goes, that's why I'm calling. I'm not at a restaurant. I'm a private chef. I go, well, how can I help you? He goes, I'm a private chef for Gianni Versace. I was the first one to his body. Would you like an exclusive interview?
Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
I said, are you kidding me right now? He goes, no. He said, meet me in an alleyway. So I had to meet him in an alleyway on South Beach, and he gave me this exclusive interview, and that was my first day in news.
Wow.
I didn't know that story.
Did you, Brian? No, I did not know that story. So, Tony, put yourself back in the 70s and 80s when there really weren't hurricanes happening in South Florida, right? There was that scare with David in 1979, but basically we cruised through a couple of decades and into the early 90s with no hurricanes. As I recall, because I came in 83, there was really no angst when hurricane season started. It just everybody knew there could be a hurricane, right? But people just didn't think about it, right? Do I remember that?
Not only did they not think about it, they didn't take it seriously at all. They just thought it would be a little wind and rain because, we were still in that cycle, which we still are today. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you look west and there come the dark clouds. And by 5 o'clock, it's storming and wind is blowing and you may lose power and for an hour and then it's up. So that's what they kind of thought a hurricane was. It's interesting because I did a interview about Andrew a couple of weeks ago. And I said, all those people who lived through Andrew, who didn't think much of the hurricane because of just the point you bring up, Brian, to this day, and it happens to me too, when you hear that we're under a warning or a watch, or that something's even could be close, there is a pit in your stomach that never even existed before. And I think that impacts people to this day who live through Andrew, because you're right, to your point, we had at least 10 years of like nothing. And even David, that everybody was looking at, skirted us to the point where there was nothing to it.
It was gusty. I was there evening that David went by, and it was kind of windy right at the beach, but that was it.
Yeah, it wasn't much. And then so now Andrew, and I remember going in your office and you had all your maps out and you had your rulers out and you were doing all your things and you look up and you go, what's up? And I go, so what's the deal? You got to like fill me in on what's the deal. He goes, and you looked at me and you went, this could really be bad. And I'm thinking, oh, okay, well, that's kind of odd. I called my wife and I said, listen, I don't know what the deal is, but you better make sure everything is battened down. Brian's not feeling too good about this and it's heading toward Broward. And she did. And then kind of
everything continued. I want to talk about the sequence because I don't even know a lot about the sequence, but we go back a little before Andrew. So Kelly, what was going on at WTVJ in the early 90s? So I got hired to be chief meteorologist in 1990, and you came. Was that just coincidence, or was there an expansion going on? Do you remember, what happened?
Every for those who aren't in the television business, every general manager, every news director make their mark by lining up a team. It's not unlike a sports team, where they have their players, where they believe this is the team and I'm going to sort of make a chess game out of this and I'm going to have this one here and that one here and how can we best represent our audience in this way. And so, I was brought in 1990. You were brought in 1990. Tony, of course, was there. He was the statue, the monument of sports. And honestly, Miami at that time tended to be a little bit of a revolving door. And so I was brought in 1990. And again, I had come from Tampa. And yes, that was an amazing market, too. It was big. It was vibrant, but nothing like the Miami experience. And as you said, Brian Allen, he was relatively new. a lot of people that were being brought in. And what's fascinating is I didn't get to know you, Brian, until Andrew, really. Right. It was like all of a sudden.
Yeah, because we didn't work together.
I don't
remember us working together on, because I did the evenings. What were you doing at the
right time? Well, they tend to bring people in when you are from another market, and people don't like change. Audience members don't like change necessarily. None of us do. So what they try to do is just sort of try to integrate you in little nuggets. And so when I was first brought in, it was the mornings. Then they put me on the noon, and then maybe it was the five. Mm-hmm. And so I believe by the time Andrew hit,
so much for sleep patterns, right, Kelly?
What's that?
So much for sleep patterns when you first started.
Right. Yeah. Sleep, what's that? I was young. It didn't matter. But then I was put on the 6 and 11, and well, you're absolutely right. We didn't take hurricane threats seriously. And in fact, I was in another town when it looked like this thing was going to be something. And as I was flying over Miami, just about to land at MIA, I took a look down and I just thought, how is this whole landscape going to change if this Andrew comes ashore? And then I started to listen to the people around me, and they started to talk about, we're going to have a hurricane party. Yeah, it's going to be fun. And I just thought, you need to really start paying attention. Yeah. And and so I got back really quickly. Remember, there weren't many cell phones. So I was out of town, and I just thought, I got to get on a plane immediately. And
So when was this you came back? And what do you remember about that week before, Andrew? This must have been late in the week, because we didn't really think much about it until, you know, quite late the week before it hit. Sunday night, Monday morning. You know, the first time I really started waving the flag in a big way was Friday afternoon and on the late news.
Right. So I flew in Saturday morning, and we were already into 24/7 coverage at that point. And I was watching you, watching Bob Weaver, watching Brian Allen. And I just thought, wow, this is serious. And we're telling people, you know, how to prepare and what to do to your houses. And I thought, this is serious. This is something that I need to really get my head around and be prepared for. And if you'll recall, Tony, back me up on this. We did 24/7 coverage, not only during Andrew, but 2 weeks after. We had no regular programming in. Because the recovery was huge. People needed that information.
I remember that vividly, Kelly. You're so right.
Because I remember, because I think we were on noon to midnight. Like somebody else was on in the morning, and then but they ran some recorded something overnight after the fact. But Tony, that week before Andrew, I mean, we didn't think anything special about it, right?
No, we really didn't. I remember, you know, you brought it up that Friday night is when you really started like kind of going, hey, pay attention, you know, they're knocking on the on the door here. And I think, by the way, and just a sort of a moment to give this podcast some immediacy here, it is what, 11:23 on the 2nd of September, breaking news, our first Atlantic hurricane just happened, right? Danielle was announced, right? So
way up in the North Atlantic, I mean, because
it's remarkable that we're already September 1st and it's our first Atlantic hurricane. It's like, how does that happen? Yeah. But Ryan, to answer your question, no, that whole week was like, okay, we see it out there. And one of the reasons I think is because it was so small. It wasn't a big, enormous hurricane, right? And we could see satellite for the first time, because again, let's go back to we didn't have a hurricane for a decade, and now meteorology changed and all of our tech changed, so you could actually see a satellite photo.
Well, the forecast though were for it to go north and stay away,
and
Friday when I you know said, okay, we need to really start talking about this, that was because it was Friday. I was worried that something might change over the weekend and people would be, you know, wherever they were going to be, and you know, out on the boat or whatever over the weekend. So if it had been a Tuesday, I probably wouldn't have said that, because the forecast was still, in fact, the forecast Saturday morning when it became a hurricane was still to Central Florida.
It was downgraded too.
Right. That was Thursday. It was not even a circulation. Yeah. Yeah.
We sort of threw up our arms and went, what's the big deal? It's a depression. It's another rainstorm. And then boom, it just sort of, again.
It blew up and it kept coming south all through Saturday. Every advisory brought it farther and farther south. So my story that week before was, if you remember, Al Jarome ran the NBC stations in, I think, when we were hired in 1990, and Dick Lobo was the general manager, who was so supportive of me, was a friend of Al Jarome's and whatnot. And Al had been let go in New York, and John Rohrbeck took over, and the word was, you got to make a change in Miami. You're not making enough progress against Ann Bishop and WPLG. And Sharon Scott, the wonderful my friend and news director, came to me in June and said, they're making me make a change. So,
You were, I remember that.
Yeah. So I was, I was told to go find a job. So I had found a job. And on that, what my schedule was going to be is I was going to go to my place in North Carolina. I had a little house in the mountains there on that Thursday. And then on Sunday, I was going to go to New York to finalize the job with CBS in New York. And Sharon came to me and said, on Wednesday, said, "What, are you going to go tomorrow?" Because I had told her about everything. She knew about, the job. She knew about my travel. I said, "No, I'm going to stick around and see what happens. I'll just delay it a day. Maybe I'll go on Friday and we'll see." And so my appointment to finalize the New York thing was 10 a.m. Monday, August 24th, 1992, mm-hmm. right? And my replacement was due to fly in that day, the same day. And I happen to know that because I happen to see the airline ticket sitting on the desk outside Sharon's office.
Just happened to see it.
What a business.
Anyway, so that was my week before.
I remember that, Brian. I didn't know what your job was, but I remember being told, and this wasn't just rumor. I remember being told by someone in Sharon's office that you were told that someone else was coming in, and.
I mean, they gave me 7 months notice. They were as good about it as they could, but the word came from New York. It wasn't anybody in Miami's
decision. No.
I've been around broadcasting for a long time. So not that I felt bad about it. And I was actually kind of looking forward to the adventure in New York. I hadn't spent a lot of time in New York City at the time, but I'd spent enough to know that, it would be interesting and fun.
You're telling that story. You're like the Aaron Judge, Aaron Judge just bet on himself and he's about to break all kinds of records without a contract. Here you are, betting on yourself. You stick around and look at what happened. I mean, that's pretty remarkable. I knew that you were being told that you were going to be replaced, but the subsequent moments and how you handled all of that was, as classy and as dignified as you possibly could. I mean,
the whole thing is just such a, my little slice of an unbelievable sequence of days and stories. And let's take a quick break. I'll be back with Tony Segreto and Kelly Craig in just a moment. On that Saturday, I went in at 11 a.m., went on the air at noon, standing in front of a green screen with a phone number for people to call in. And as I recall, Jerry Helfman and Jose Diaz-Balart were the weekend team, mm-hmm. and they were there. And I'm sure of that because on YouTube, that 11 o'clock news intro is there. But when did you guys get called in? Kelly, when did they tell you, you got to come in and do something special for this coverage?
Well, again, I called from North Carolina, and that must have been because I was there because my godson had just been born, and I was visiting him. And when I was kind of watching on, was the Weather Channel around then? Weather Channel was there.
Yeah,
we must have been watching Weather Channel, and I just said, I cannot be here. Mm-hmm. I've got to go, and I want to say maybe I flew in Saturday morning. Yeah.
And then somebody must have called you and said, "Okay, Sunday, the next day, you got to come in and on some or other shift, I guess."
Gathered all my clothes. I gathered clothes for 2 weeks. I put water in my bathtub.
Mm-hmm.
The water sat there for 3 weeks. And then I got all my clothes and everything I was going to need. And, you know, I had all the glamorous anchor clothes. But as you'll recall, right after the hurricane, they sent me right down to the field. So all the glamour clothes went away. I remember Sharon Scott, the news director, at one point came out and said, "Take off all your earrings, take off your necklaces, your rings. This is not a glamour gig anymore. And it's just going to be the camera and you guys, and a very intimate experience, and let's get through this, and let's let our viewers know that we are all in this together, and here we go. This is why you got into the business." And she was absolutely right. Yeah. Absolutely right.
Tony, do you remember when you got the word to come in that Sunday, and you know that?
Well, I was already there. Because the Dolphins played. Mm-hmm. Right. I was getting prepared for Sunday night sports final. And so the game was over. It was 1 o'clock game. The game was over, 3-4 o'clock. I was in the office by 4:30. And, you know, all the scattering. And we're talking amongst ourselves back in the sports department. And you'll recall that we always positioned the sports department far away from the newsroom because we were pretty loud and gregarious, screaming at TVs for all different games and stuff. So we didn't want to bother the newsroom. But when I walked in, you could feel that there was a whole difference here. You could feel something going on. And the talk amongst us in the sports department was, are we even going to have sports final now because of what's going on with the storm? So I remember walking into Sharon Scott, and she said, "Hey, we don't know what's going to happen, but you know what? Can you do me a favor? Just sort of stick around." I said, "Okay." I had no idea. And that's when soon after that, our anchor, she called me and she said, "You're not going to believe this, but so-and-so decided to leave because he was scared and wanted to be home with his family. Can you sit with Brian?" And this was Sunday evening, probably, I don't know, my guess is 7:30, 8 o'clock at night. And I said, "Sure, absolutely. And I remember calling Roseanne and saying, "I'm not coming home. Make sure you." That's when I told her. I said, "You know, Brian was sort of waving the flag," and that's how that all happened. Because I was already there, and you were scurrying about. And I remember Kelly coming in, and you know, it was sort of like, "Okay, this is serious," but it really wasn't. Sirius hadn't hit critical yet.
Yeah, yeah. You know? But Sunday evening, we still didn't really know. Yeah. We knew it was coming in our general direction, but we didn't really understand the scope of it early Sunday evening.
Yeah, we weren't in DEFCON mode yet.
But through the evening, Sunday evening is when we knew. Then that Sunday, which of course went all the way into Monday. I was in the studio, and people rotated in, but I didn't really know what was going on in the news department, because Sharon and the news team and the engineers would come to the anchor desk, and we would have our little meetings at the anchor desk to kind of talk about what was going on with the storm, what the strategy should be, and you know what we needed to be doing. But do you know what was going on in the news department at that time? Where was everybody gone? Or
no,
I just
no,
don't
no,
remember.
No.
I know not everybody was gone, but people were in the field.
They were out in the field. Yeah. They were out in the field talking about what to do to prepare. For instance, you know, the lumber. at the hardware stores. You know, we had to cover all of that. We would go to shelters, talking about what shelters were going to be opening up. This was a time of preparation where people were kind of like, really, do we have to prepare? Should we put our shutters up? Shouldn't we?
Were you in the field that day, Kelly? Did you go out? Were you in the field before?
No, I was in the field completely after the storm was down there. Yeah. But all of our reporters were dispatched. And Carrie Sanders, who, of course, was, you know, one of the major standouts of Hurricane Andrew coverage. I worked with him in Tampa prior to coming here, and he covered Hugo in Charleston. So he had, you know, a leg up on a lot of the other reporters in the sense that he was right out there in the thick of it. So he too was out there. But there was so much to be done. And again, people had not before Andrew really taken this seriously. So there was a lot of preparation to do. And I think we started doing cut-ins. You know how we would do cut-ins maybe for 5 minutes, for 10 minutes. I don't think we went into the total 24/7 coverage till very late on Sunday night. But we did take the opportunity to cut into programming and say, let's go to so-and-so in the field who's showing us this and showing us that. And again, I keep hearkening back. Sorry to interrupt you, Brian, is that, you know, we didn't have a phone we could look at to say what's open, what's not. People relied on us because right now it wasn't about newspapers. Yes, some radio stations had coverage and very, very admirable. But mostly they were relying on television to see what to do. There was no other media at that time.
Yeah, that was the way. That's what you did, right? That was what you always did, is you turned on the television, just let it stay on, and that's how you kept up with what
we were relying on the people to help us too, because we needed them to be our eyes and ears, and that's why we kept saying we're all in this together. You tell us, we can tell everybody else. I think that was a big part of it, because we didn't know what was open, what wasn't. Lines for gas stations were, you know, unbelievable. No more
grocery
water
stores.
On the
right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first time we were seeing this sort of feel from the community, right? Because they were starting to just start hoarding things, and trying to find water was like next to impossible. And this was still, and this was only when it was, you know, it was the small storm, but I think we alerted everybody to the point where they took it seriously enough to say, we better have provisions that we need, whether it's just something as rudimentary as gas and water, that we can have over a period of time if we lose power.
I think another thing is that it was a different time, in that if people went on television and said, okay, folks, here's what you need to do, that people at home were inclined to believe that. Where now they're not inclined to believe that. They're inclined to go check, you know, five other sources on wherever they're going to check them on. So it was a different time. And by Sunday, as the storm was getting stronger, it was heading toward the Bahamas, it was forecast to hit, Dade County-ish at that time, you know, through the day Sunday. So I think that was part of it. So how did you guys end up being sort of the last two anchors left? Because through the day,
Knocked everybody off. Yeah. We just knocked them off.
I mean, because I sat at that anchor desk from 9 a.m. Saturday or Sunday morning. And then, you know, and there's on YouTube, Bob Mayer was there, and a variety of anchor people were there for parts of the day. But then it all ended up just the three of us by Sunday evening. And then Sunday evening, if you recall, the streets were empty. People were in their place, right? There wasn't this any kind of franticness. People kind of thought they were prepared. But how did you, I don't know how you guys ended up being the only two left at that. Somebody made, maybe Sharon made the decision. You know, I just sat at the desk and people came and went. You know,
well, the other anchors were out in the field that day. If you'll recall, Tony, a lot of them were out in the field doing stories, talking about the preparation. So when it got to the point where everybody needs to get in and batten down, they were sent home, with the exception of Carrie Sanders and a couple of others who were actually out in it. But the reporters, if you'll remember, were calling in via phone. to tell us what was going on in their neighborhood. How are their neighbors preparing? What is the mood? What is the vibe? So all of our reporters were still very much in touch via telephone. But to answer your question, the reason why the two of us were left was because it was all hands on deck, and the anchors were out in the field throughout the day. And then ultimately, they were sent to their homes to batten down, with the idea that they would still be in touch via telephone.
That's right. I had forgotten about that.
Yeah, and for me, it was the Tom left, and it was like 8 o'clock, and I was there for Sports Final, and we still weren't sure if we were going to still run Sports Final. So that's when Sharon said to me, "Get in the chair now and just hang in there." Yeah. So that's kind of my. That's when I showed up and you looked at me and like, I remember you looking at me going, what? And I'm going,
but even back then I was a believer in broadcasters, you know, people that could broadcast anything, right? Because they could take in information and dispense it and sort it and tell stories. And that's what broadcasting is, right? Yeah. So people that are people that are good at sports very often are good at telling stories. In fact, always are good at telling stories. So,
you know, Brian, I have to tell you this. And again, this is from my heart. For me, and again, you have to remember, unlike Kelly, you know, my history was experience. It wasn't news. It was experience in living life. And because of our relationship, Brian, because I and maybe I'm wrong, but I really felt a deep respect for you. I knew that. But I also felt you having a deep respect for me and what I did.
Exactly.
And how I did it. And I didn't feel uncomfortable. And Kelly and I were just, before this podcast is over, she's going to do her impression of Leave It to Beaver because but Kelly and I were just, we just hit it off, man. We were just, you know, we loved what we did. We were cut ups. We were, you know, we wanted to have fun. And so I you made me feel extremely welcome in here you are in the midst of your world. And Kelly and I were just like, all right, here we go. And so I felt pretty darn comfortable coming in to sit there. And little did we know afterwards, again, we had no clue how this was going to unfold.
No, we didn't.
We were just, you know, we were, to Kelly's point, you know, we were getting people in place, but we were kind of making it up as we were going along because this was uncharted territory.
We were totally making it up because we weren't really sure what the storm was going to do. I mean, it really was, as the storm did this, we did that. And the storm looked like it was going to do this, we did.
We were being more reactionary than anything else. We were reacting off of what the storm was doing rather than being proactive, because there was no way to be proactive in that case because it was so unpredictable.
Well, especially the Sunday evening, and I, you know, it's all kind of the Sunday is kind of a blur to me. But one of the things I do remember, Tony, is we're giving out shelter addresses, and we got to the ones in Hialeah, which are so confusing because, you know, the streets have two different sets of numbers and Miami-Dade County numbers and Hialeah numbers, and I was tired by that point. And then the way you convert is you subtract 54 from the Miami-Dade County numbers to get the Hialeah numbers. And I just couldn't do that in my head. And I said, I don't know who numbered those streets in Hialeah, but I hope they're dead.
Yeah.
And,
I don't remember that at all.
You don't remember that?
I do.
No.
That's on YouTube somewhere.
That, I remember that.
But because they had shelter addresses that had combination Hialeah numbers and Miami-Dade numbers, and I'm trying to remember which side of the Palmetto Expressway is that on, because nobody had, you know, Google Maps or anything to find anything. And so how would you get there?
That's so funny. I remember us talking about that, Brian, specifically because, you know, one of the main streets is still not the main street in Hialeah, the 103rd in Miami, but then once you cross the
49th,
line,
yes.
Hialeah, 49th Street. Yes. Like, how did that happen?
Yeah. That happened. I know. See, I did all those Miami history things. I can tell you how it happened. It happened because Hialeah was this distant burg you know, back in the day, it was not connected to Miami. It was not connected to Miami-Dade County. So all those Miami-Dade County type streets and Miami, they were actually the streets that are Miami-Dade County grid are were the original Miami grid from the early 20s. So anyway, there was a separate place. It's like Homestead. It was a separate place, has its own set of numbers down there. And you go to Homestead and you, every sign has multiple numbers on it, you know, and sometimes with a name besides, just to make it extra confusing.
Do you guys recall this? Is sort of, again, this is sort of just, I feel like the brain soil is being tilled here. I remember this mail carrier, and back then, mail carriers were your friends because they were your constant mail carriers. Like if they would be there, if they were employed by the mail service for 10 years, that was their route for 10 years.
Yeah, you got to know them for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, you gave them Christmas cards. Mm-hmm. You gave them things for Thanksgiving. They were part of your family. And by the way,
the last thing a mail carrier wanted at Christmas time was another card to carry.
They didn't mind the card if there was a little cash in it now.
That's true. Well, now you're talking.
They didn't want a card with a crushed cookie in it. Or a good bottle of scotch, something like that. But I remember this mail carrier walking through Homestead with tears in his eyes. Because if you recall, all the street signs were down. You couldn't tell neighborhood from neighborhood. And he was wandering around going, where's my neighborhood? Mm-hmm. And he couldn't find it. And I remember that like it was yesterday. And your heart to this, I mean, that this moment, me even telling you, my heart breaks. Mm-hmm. Because they couldn't find anything. And for someone who walked those streets daily for years, couldn't recognize.
People told me that they walked down to the end of their block and they were lost because it was like they walked into a different world and nobody recognized anything. And I was just, as I was saying, I was down in Homestead recently going back over down the streets that I had walked away from Harris Field Park there, you know, to where I met people, a young mother and her baby and in the debris and this hellacious situation. Hey, Brian here. I'll be back with Tony Segreto and Kelly Craig after this quick break. Did you guys alternate at the desk on Sunday? Is that how it worked? Do you remember? Because I remember, Tony, that you and I were together at midnight because we had said midnight is when everybody needs to be in place because that's when the first band might arrive. It was just a wild guess. And sure enough, it arrived at midnight. And I remember that. And I remember, Kelly, you and I were sitting there at 3 o'clock when we started talking about moving off the set. And then
I was still there at 3 o'clock.
You were still there at 3 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. Three of us moved into that area.
Yeah, but you went first because when I walked over there, you were already in there.
Yeah, I was in there. Yeah.
So I remember Kelly and I talking at 3 o'clock, but I don't remember in between. So in between there at about 2 a.m., I think is when the idea of get the mattress off the bed came to me. And I got that from a 1926 book written by a guy named L.F. Reardon. And he wrote about spending the 1926 hurricane with his family in a house in Coral Gables. And at one point, they get a mattress and use it for protection. And that's where the mattress idea is. I'm racking my brain saying this is going to be, you know, a worst case thing for people in their homes. What else can we do? And I had this idea of the mattress came to me. That was 2 o'clock-ish. But I don't remember.
It was a woman who called and said, my door just blew through.
Well, that was later, right? That was after.
Was it?
That was while the storm was happening, right? This is before.
I'll tell you what, the most brilliant thing we did, pardon my interruption, mm-hmm. the most brilliant thing we did was having hooked up, and that was you, Brian, was with Y100.
Right. Yeah, that worked. That worked. I mean, that saved the day. That saved the day for so many people, including us. And do you know that line, which I had talked to a bunch of radio stations and finally negotiated that with the general manager at Y100, you know, a couple months before in the summer. And that line was tested on the Monday before Andrew, exactly 1 week before the hurricane. So when the engineers came to me and said, oh, remember that line that we're putting into Y100's transmitter? I just tested it with the Y100 engineer. It's all good now.
And I mean, when you think about the confluence thing that happened, that 1 week happened. Yeah. So now everybody else goes off, everybody's tower goes down. So everybody's off the air but us, right?
In English,
We're on radio.
Yeah.
And then the radar goes down at the National Hurricane Center. So our radar is now the radar of record. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about all of those things that happened, and we're the last three standing.
Yeah. So what are the lessons of Hurricane Andrew? And I say the number one lesson is that the worst does happen. You know, usually storms we can turn away. It's not as bad as they say it could have been at a certain location, usually, which is the way the system works, because you always overwarn, always. But the number two and close behind is preparation works. Because we wouldn't be here talking today if Sharon and Jim Ogle, who was the assistant news director, and Dick Lobo, who was the general manager, hadn't bought into the plan of really preparing the TV station and having the idea of being the hurricane station actually be part of the plan, right? I mean, nobody else decided to do that, so they bought into that idea. When I went to WTVJ, and here we are 30 years later. It's mm-hmm. kind of amazing, yeah.
Yes, that radio line, because people always say, well, wait a minute, TV got knocked off the air. What did you do? Especially young people. Well, transistor radios, guys. Do you know what a transistor radio is?
Yeah.
It's a little box that you turn. And
we don't even use that word anymore. I say that to even, you know, people in their 30s, and they go, what? You know, transistor what? I mean, portable radio, they'll get a portable radio idea, but a transistor radio is just, that's not a term that we... So the rest of that story is, so I make this deal with David Ross, who was the general manager at Y100, and I go up there to the studio, and the Y100 studio then was at the corner of Sunrise and Federal Highway in Fort Lauderdale, you know, where Federal Highway bends and goes north, and you can go, or you go by the Gateway Theater there, you go across the bridge to Fort Lauderdale Beach. And I go, okay, we're all good. And I walk out of the studio there, and I look over, and I go, oh, wait a minute, the Intracoastal's right there. If we have a hurricane, this place is getting evacuated, this studio. So I go back and I say, you know, we really ought to put the line to the Y100 transmitter and then another line to the studio. And normally those two lines would just be connected together so that the studio could get our audio. Well, guess what? That Sunday, the day before Andrew hit, the Y100 engineer goes to the transmitter, takes the wire from the studio, our studio in Miami, hooks it up to the transmitter directly because they evacuated the Y100 studio. So it was just, you know, it was kind of one thing after the other of, think about what could happen and plan for that. And it all happened. That was, it was this incredible confluence of events. So, of course, we all remember the calls that we took live on the air as houses were coming apart. Do you remember how that happened? Because in my mind, I just don't remember giving out a number, or did people just find the TV station somehow? Do you have any recollection?
I think we gave out the numbers.
Did we?
We did. Because remember, we the information that we had was so scant. Because as you said, the information, we sent our reporters home at that point, a few that we had out there, but not many. We had our reporters calling in. But yeah, we solicited, hey, let us know what's going on. Or if you have a question, that's really what we were soliciting people to call in so that they could be helped one-on-one. Mm-hmm. And that's when they started calling in. And then at that point, the VCRs, you know, we were saying, if you can take a video that we could get later, that would be great too. And of course, we had some people who did just that. But yeah, we were giving out that we were actively telling folks to tune into Y100 when you lose power, not if, but when. Mm-hmm. And also to call us. If you have a question for Brian Norcross, give us a call. Yeah.
Yeah. So and I didn't remember what we were in the middle of the night there. I didn't, like I said, a lot of it is kind of a blur. But that ended up being a seminal moment that when people were calling in. And they were calling in from West Kendall. So, not Homestead, because Homestead, the systems generally weren't working by that time. This was 5 o'clock in the morning. So, Homestead had already been mauled in the first wave at that point. And then because all those calls that we got were, as I tracked them down later, were from Kendall or from West Kendall, west of the Palmetto, even as far north as Southwest 8th Street. I think Southwest 11th Street, one of the calls, but they were getting hit really hard and holding the door, trying to hold the door, against the storm.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Brian. I remember Jim Ogle walking in with the phone numbers to call.
Okay. All right. Well, good. So that's what I'm saying.
These are the numbers to call. And we weren't even prepared for that. We kept calling this place the bunker. Mm-hmm. And I think we should sort of give context to this, that basically what you have to remember where WTVJ was. It was the first movie theater in Miami. So we were sitting basically in the balcony of that movie theater.
Kind of the mezzanine, yeah.
Yeah, and that area was all concrete. Mm-hmm. And you had scoped that out earlier, Brian, and said, if we need to be safe, this is going to be our safe room. So we're sitting basically on concrete bleachers, for lack of a better way of putting it. And we had one camera with one light, and we had a couple microphones, one handheld, and then we had lavaliers that we were passing around to each other in many cases, right? So we could hear what the caller was, and we had a little monitor, like a little black and white monitor that was on the floor. Do you recall that, Kelly?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The only way I could see the radar was on the monitor. So John Lugering, who was the floor director, and Bruce Carter was the production manager at the time, they stayed there with us the whole time and set that up in that 3 to 3:30 half hour and got all that ready to go.
And because this was at night, I remember us hearing things hit the building. I remember us hearing things hit the building. And when everything cleared, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, I remember walking out the back door, and we noticed that we had three big satellite dishes and a couple of smaller ones. And the smaller ones were sort of mangled and like Superman had come and decided to twist them up. And what are you laughing at, Kelly? And us saying, other than that, nothing else seemed as if it was impacted. I mean, like, what was hitting the building? And we were looking at, like, okay, so what's the big deal? And then we started getting pictures in from Homestead.
Although, remember, Xavier Suarez, the mayor of Miami at the time, while we were still in the bunker, and that's a loose term because the wall in front of us that divided the studio from where we were sitting was flimsy. It was all that was soundproofing is all that was, right? But when we were still there, he came and sat there and to assure us and everybody that Miami survived, Miami is fine. And I said, don't think because we haven't heard from South Dade that the news is good, because we hadn't heard from Cutler Ridge and, anywhere in South Dade by that time, even in those overnight hours.
Even the Today Show went on the air at 7 a.m. and said, well, it looks like Miami,
has dodged the bullet. Dodged the bullet.
Remember?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Now that you bring it up, I do remember that.
Yeah, so it wasn't until, and remember that the Kerry Sanders, I want to go back to Kerry Sanders. So Kerry and his photographer Steve were in this car heading south, and I remember Sharon asking me, where can they be? Because the weather was getting really bad. And I said, the only thing I know is a Metro Rail. The Metro Rail in South Miami is that's not going anywhere. And they hid the car behind the Metro Rail stanchion, as I recall, and rode it mm-hmm. out inside that car as the car was rocking. And, of course, Kerry did that iconic video film back then. Was it film or video? I guess it kind of looks like film as you look at it.
It was video, but yeah, he was giving it this, and the microphone was here. It was quite dramatic.
It was, and it was scary. It was because it was ripping through there for sure. So mm-hmm. so when did you guys go home?
I'm still not home.
I truly don't remember.
I remember, to Kelly's point about not being glamour anymore, I remember them coming out and saying, take your ties off, roll your sleeves up. You guys are working now. And I remember somewhere around 7 a.m., 8 a.m., Sharon had called. I even forget who the male and females were coming in to give us a break, but to not go home. Check on our homes, but don't go home. So, again, no cell phones around. So fortunately, everybody's still. And to this day, we have one landline in our home. Everything else does on the cell phone because of Andrew. And
yeah, although a lot of places you can't get that anymore. Where I'm in Miami Beach, you can't get that service anymore.
Really? Really?
No, a lot of places, they don't maintain the copper wires that it takes to do that.
So I called home and said to my wife, I said, I'm not coming home. I don't know when I'll be home. And and I remember staying, and they said, try to get a couple hours sleep. So I went to my office and slept in my chair for an hour. And then probably by 9:30, 10 o'clock, I was back on the air. Kelly, I don't recall if you remember what did you, I think we both went off the same time, right?
Yes.
Yeah, like about 8 a.m.-ish, it seems to me.
Yeah, it was 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
And it was only for a couple hours, right, Kelly?
Yeah. I mean, I honestly don't remember how long it took before I went home, and that was okay. That was all right. I slept on the floor of my office for maybe 4 or 5 days, and then I couldn't get to my home because there was no power, which meant I would have to walk up 17 flights to get to my home. But one of the producers opened her home to me, and I was able to sleep in a bed maybe the fourth or fifth day. Sure. And I do remember they brought in a washer dryer at the station so that people who were there forever and ever could actually do their laundry there. And that's how we lived. It was a great bonding experience.
Well, I had forgotten about that because I remember 8 o'clock was when I got up and went into the newsroom and then spent a couple hours in the newsroom taking phone calls. I remember my voice was kind of like this by that time. And took a couple hours. The first call I took was from a speech therapist who said, you can't talk now. You absolutely cannot talk anymore. And don't drink anything warm and only cold and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, and then about 10 a.m., I went downstairs to an office and napped downstairs. And then about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I went back on until midnight. So it was at midnight that I think we were there. Tony, I'm sure you were there till midnight. Anyway, that's when I drove home to Coconut Grove, but I had a four-wheel drive in my hurricane preparation mode, four-wheel drive truck. So I drove up over the curbs and over the lawns and whatnot. I only lived 4 miles away to get to my house in Coconut Grove that night.
I remember because of that night, I remember how prepared we were afterwards. And Kelly, I don't know if you remember this or not, but I'm not sure if it was Wilma or what it was, but I was on the air and I remember being told, all right, come take a rest, go to your office. And by the time I got to my office, they had already put a cot up for me. I didn't have there, Andrew. So a cot was there with sheets on it and a pillow. And I went, oh, thank you, God. Because it was also them not telling me, but telling me, you're going to be here a while.
Yeah, same. Yeah, that was Rita. We had Wilma, Rita,
Katrina,
and what was the third
Katrina,
one?
Katrina, Rita, the and then Wilma in 2005. Uh-huh. Yeah. So, Tony, you talked about how Andrew kind of blew up your life. Kelly, how did it change your life?
I was going through a divorce, and my ex-husband decided, hey, my soon-to-be ex-husband decided, hey, I want to go into the weather department. And I hadn't seen him in weeks. He goes, I want to go into the weather department and watch Brian work. So he decides to show up. I didn't know whether to go in the bunker, to go into the weather. It was crazy. So in my personal life, there was a hurricane going on. And by the way, he happened to be named Andrew. I was going through a personal upheaval to begin with. And then that happened, which, you tend to put things into perspective. All jokes aside, you tend to put things into perspective. And I was so fortunate that everyone who I knew that went through this, I had a lot of friends down south, and they were calling me during when we were on the air. I got back and there was message after message saying, we're losing it. I don't know what to do. So on a very personal note, when I did get some time off, it was going down there and helping them put their lives back together. And that was probably a big life lesson to me, in the sense that when you are going through a personal problem and you think everything revolves around you, when something is going on this big and affecting so many people, how you get out of your head and how you rectify what's going on with you and really put it in perspective is to start helping others, to start serving those who you know, those who you don't know, the larger community. And so on a very personal level, it was a big learning experience for me, and a very valuable one. And to this day, when younger people come to us, and that's one of the benefits about being a little bit older, is that the younger people do come to you and say, boy, I'm going through this. I always say, how can you turn this around and give to others right now? Because productivity is sometimes the best antidote to whatever you personally are going through. So to answer your question, and I hope I didn't get too deep here, really, that's one of the major lessons that I learned, and how fortunate I felt to have been in that position, to have helped people not only leading up to the storm and during it, and to have had the privilege of sitting next to the two of you, but to have had that privilege of helping others for weeks and months and years after, having gained that experience to help them not only on television, but to help them physically and in person and spiritually thereafter.
Yeah, I can.
Well said. Well, so well said, Kelly. You're so right. I mean, that is just.
So Tony, you became a news anchor, although you still kept your foot in sports, I know, for a good long time.
It was my version of the hokey pokey.
Yeah. Well, I know, but you were a sports guy, so it fit. I mean, it would have been weird for you to drop sports.
Yeah.
I think, but well, how else did that experience change?
I'm going to go. I mean, you know, one of the stories that I tell all the time that to this day impacts me. You know, there's that story that you always hear about all these starfish on the shore, and this little boy is throwing the starfish back, and this older gentleman says, "What are you going to do? You're going to throw all the starfish back, like?" What kind of impact do you have? And he goes, well, I helped that one, and I helped this one. I'm helping this one. And I recall going down to Homestead. We were all going down there, and there was an elderly gentleman with a Nissan and a trunk open and a little canopy over the trunk and kind of extending out. And he had a Bunsen burner with one pot on it, and he was stirring it. And he had cups. And I went up to him and I said, what are you doing? He goes, I live in Tampa. I saw what happened and I felt compelled to come down here. And if all I can do is hand out a cup of soup to some people, and if that gives them some nourishment, then it's made my day. Wow. And that has stuck with me. To Kelly's point, helping people, doing something, because the world doesn't revolve around us. Our world is, Tony Segretto's world is this big, right? And there's a much bigger world out there. And if we can go and impact someone's life, there is nothing quite like it. And you need to go into it not doing it in a selfish way, but in a helpful way and in a humble way. Mm-hmm. I think that's what, other than being my life professionally totally turned upside down, personally, that's what I got from this, because it impacted me in such a profound way spiritually. There are like three or four things that have done that in my life where it just changes you and how you look at things, how you look at people, and understand that what they're going through right now, if they could just have somebody smile, you know, put an arm around them, hand them a cup of soup, it's for that moment, it changes them, right? It's their moment of like, wow, somebody cares.
Yeah. So yeah, and you know, in South Dade, the doctors that came and set up tents without being asked to, that made so much difference in Florida City. I mean, there are endless stories of people that selflessly came after that event and served because the government was incapable at that time of reacting.
So true. And correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but because of that, when you hear now, Brian, doctors going and people going to help, whether it's the war in Ukraine or whether it's, you know, when Irene happened, and those people living in the Superdome, you can not only feel what they felt, but your empathy for them and your respect and admiration for them for what they're doing out of the humble goodness, purity of their heart with no agenda. You know, the real mark of someone who is a giver is someone who gives to people who know they're never going to get anything back. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that that's such a beautiful thing. And what a beautiful lesson Andrew taught the three of us about that, because we help people that we would never recognize anymore that come up to us and say, you help me. And I go, well, really? And Kelly, I know what happens to you, and Brian, it happens to you. And even the people that called us to be able to say that, if there's that little part of you that helped them, my gosh, what a blessing. What a blessing.
I know that when people go through something, particularly men, when they went through this storm, they didn't cry. They didn't have the emotion. They were too busy battening down the hatches, getting through it. And when I was down in Homestead and I saw all of a sudden the donations that poured in throughout the country, throughout the world, that was the first time when people let their guard down and started to feel the beauty of what can happen after a disaster. And that's when I saw the emotion of these poor people that had kept up such a brave front for days and weeks. And then all of a sudden, the water, the food, the cots, the beds, how can we help? It was a feeling that we are enveloped by people who want to help us. And in fact, there were so many people trying to get in that I remember the feds finally said, hey, listen, our people are trying to get home to their houses to check out what happened. Right now, people are flooding the streets with bringing things in. We need to have a more organized approach to this, because people were so adamant about helping people. It came from their hearts. You're absolutely right, Tony.
Yeah, it's a
What did we learn? We learned this, that there are two things that can take a community, as fractured as South Florida was, there are two things that can bring a community together: disasters and championship sports teams. Those are the two things that bring communities together, right? I remember my father going to a Dolphins game right after we had one of our disturbances, one of our riots. And there was this whole other conversation about whether to play that game. It was the game where in the mud where the Dolphins went to the Super Bowl. They were playing the Jets in the mud at the Orange Bowl. I remember my father going, here we are, we just went through this riot. Yet I'm sitting next to a black man, a Hispanic man, and we're all cheering for the same thing. And we're high-fiving each other and all of this, where 24 hours earlier, there was these, you know, it was shooting in the streets. Mm-hmm. So we've come out of this by going, okay, disasters and these two things bring communities together, and nothing quite like Andrew brought us together like that.
Yeah, no, that was truly the great, well, there were many legacies of Andrew, but that was one of the great ones that happened in South Florida at the time. So guys, we've gone on and on much longer than I normally do. In fact, I think this is probably a record, but it was absolutely worth
it. We got three talkers here for sure.
Absolutely, yeah. So thanks, thanks so much for taking the time and being part of this and being so great and everything we've done together for so many years.
Well, I love you guys, and I am so blessed. We are so blessed that 30 years after the storm, it's like we're taking up like there's been no time at all. And privileged to be part of this, Brian. Thank you so much for inviting me.
And Brian, to Kelly, I am honored. I'm absolutely honored. And thank you for thinking of us like you have, and for including us in all these things that you do. Honestly, you were the stalwart here. We were just sort of hanging. I don't want to speak to Kelly, but we were hanging on. You know, we were just on the rope as the boat was going, you know, keep hold on as tight as you can. And whatever we did to help you, we're blessed to be able to do that. And we're grateful that you defer to both of us. I tell you what, I love you guys. Like, you know, I've worked with a lot of people before, but to be in that moment with the two of you was extraordinary, and something that I will always cherish.
Well, me too. And I couldn't have done, you know, what I did without you guys. So anyway, it's so wonderful to see you again. And I hope we can get together in person one of these days soon. I'll be right back. And welcome back. Well, wasn't that amazing? The fact that Kelly, Tony, and I went through that event together, that all our backup systems were in place and worked. Well, it was due to a combination of luck and hard work by a lot of people at WTVJ. As you heard, our boss, Sharon Scott, was orchestrating a lot of it from behind the scenes. Plus, there were all the other professionals who worked at the TV station. They were involved at that time. Hopefully, we'll never have to find out what a modern version of Andrew will be like, but of course, if we hang around long enough, the odds are we will. Next week on the podcast, I'll talk to one of the great hurricane and climate scientists of this era. Professor Kerry Emanuel from MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts, will be on. Besides being an author on some 200 scientific papers, he wrote one of the most interesting books on the history and the science of hurricanes called Divine Wind. We'll talk hurricanes and policy and how thinking has evolved as research has sharpened and been refined into the effects of a warming world and a changing climate. That's next week right here. Be sure you subscribe to our Tracking the Tropics podcast so you can get an alert when a new podcast is posted. A reminder, download the Fox Weather app. First, you can get your local forecast without a bunch of annoying ads to scroll past, and you can watch the live stream of Fox Weather on your phone or your iPad by just clicking in the upper right, and it's all free. And you can watch Fox Weather at foxweather.com or on the Roku channel on your TV or YouTube TV, Amazon Fire, and lots of other streaming platforms. So I'll see you there on the Fox Weather stream when the tropics are active. And follow me on Twitter at @BNorcross and on Facebook and Instagram, just Google Brian Norcross Weather. Until next time, I am Brian Norcross. Be well and stay informed.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity podcast so I can get you making money right now. Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in free-fall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.